Preston Had the Blues, Sunday, September 10th at the Lamellais Royal Theater, located at 11523 Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles. When Houston Had the Blues is a celebration of the city that gave us such giants like Lightnin' Hopkins, Big Mama Thornton,
You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog,
Clifton Chenier, and Bobby Blue Bland. Join us September 10th at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. for VIP reception with a meet and greet with the director of the film, Alan Swire, plus myself, Bill Gardner, host of Rhapsody in Black, and a cavalcade of movie stars from the film, including Billy Vera, Carla Olson of the Textones, and more. More information and tickets available at kpfk.org.
Further on up the road.
Welcome back to another week of Gray Zone Radio. This week we'll listen to the first half of a Gray Zone live stream from the BRICS Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, with the Gray Zone's Anya Parampel and a special guest, Ahmed Caballo of African Stream, and hosts Max Blumenthal and Wyatt Reed. They discuss the BRICS Summit, a historical gathering of over 60 nations to build a more inclusive and democratic financial order. Let's take a listen.
So what's happening in South Africa now, and why does so much of the world's population consider this to be such a momentous event, Anya?
This week in Johannesburg, actually slightly north of Johannesburg in Sandton, South Africa, the presidents of the BRICS, minus R, the foreign minister of Russia came, but it was a presidential summit technically. And they met to really hash out the final decision, what is now the Johannesburg 2 Declaration, which is the first official, well, not actually. South Africa was technically added to BRICS as an expansion, I believe, 4 years after the initial 2006 foundation of BRICS. But this is the largest expansion of BRICS, official membership that has happened in 15 years of BRICS as a conception. And so there were conferences of world leaders. They had a business summit where business leaders and delegates from not only the official members, but the members that were applying, because BRICS has, over the past year and a half, experienced an exponential influx of membership applications from around 30 countries. And so they have been, since those applications were submitted, the founding members and also South Africa, deliberating to decide who they were actually going to accept, if they were going to accept anyone, and actually ultimately define the terms of BRICS and who's let in and who's not. Because until this point, that had never been officially spelled out. And then ultimately, on the third day, there were not only the initial delegates and media outlets, state media outlets from those nations, then we had an influx of even more international media. And suddenly it became clear something big was coming down. And sure enough, on the third day, South African president, the host, Cyril Ramaphosa, announced that they had agreed to accept 6 new members into BRICS. And there was a lot of speculation, more so in non-Western media. The Western journalists that were here were really caught up in the question of whether or not BRICS would expand at all, or whether or not Modi and Xi can sit in the same room with each other, or they were inventing and projecting so much hysteria and drama that they missed the, and they obviously haven't been aware of the fact that this was long in the works. And so they were like, are there going to be really new members of BRICS? Yes, obviously that was not the question. The question was who, and we found out that it is Ethiopia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Argentina, and Iran that now the language is they've been formally invited to join BRICS, but in reality, this is an acceptance of application and they will become full members in January of next year, which also happens to be when Russia, according to the rotation, becomes the president of the BRICS organization.
So Ahmed, you're focused on Africa. Why is it so important that this BRICS conference was held in South Africa? And what is the mood on the continent coming out of this gathering?
Yeah, it's an important question. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. I'll explain why. So initially, in the lead up to BRICS, you know, I'm talking 6 months ago when the ICC arrest warrant happened against Putin, there was all these fantastic statements from the leaders of the ANC, the leaders of the EFF, saying, we will not arrest Putin, we'll be his bodyguard. Why is Tony Blair not being arrested? Why is not George Bush? And that, you know, was a source of pride. And then in the lead up to BRICS, I think, I'm not sure about the timeline, maybe it was a month and a half before, 2 months ago, it felt like Cyril Ramaphosa folded under pressure from the DA, the Democratic Alliance, which is the second biggest party in South Africa, as well as, you know, the so-called international community, i.e. the West. And that was a bit disappointing. And as we were traveling around Johannesburg, traveling around South Africa, we're making a documentary, so we were filming some other stuff, and we were speaking to taxi drivers and local people. What do you think about BRICS? They were optimistic about the idea of BRICS, but disappointed that the person leading the charge from a South African perspective was Cyril Ramaphosa, who does represent like the moderate wing of the ANC. If you think back to President Zuma, despite his many controversies, when it came to Omar al-Bashir coming to South Africa, he said, come, do whatever you want. You know, we're not going to arrest him. Well, Ramaphosa seemed to fold on the big question. Then the BRICS summit happened, and I don't know how Anya felt, but the first 2 days, it kind of, I felt a bit deflated. I did personally, watching the speeches. You know, we had Modi mentioned the G20. It felt like he was trying to please both sides. Putin kind of made a shot at Ramaphosa day two, said that when Russia hosts the BRICS, it's not going to succumb to external pressure, which definitely felt like a shot at Ramaphosa. Ramaphosa then made
on
a shot.
On day three, he said, Mr. Putin's very busy. He couldn't attend.
Yeah. It felt like, okay, this is a great idea, but is there unity amongst these BRICS nations to really be the vehicle that we want it to be? And then day three came and everyone was just buzzing. Absolutely everyone was buzzing. You know, the engagement on African Stream, the people that we spoke to. And the reason why everyone's buzzing is because Africa is the most sanctioned continent on the planet. We have been bullied. We've had our leaders assassinated. And we need, you know, a multipolar world now. We can't wait anymore. Someone actually said, we did an Instagram live yesterday. We had a African guy from Brooklyn. He says, BRICS or perish, which is reference to Kwame Nkrumah's famous terms regarding African unity, unite or perish. And really, we need something to really get this tiger of imperialism off our back. We need other options. And BRICS represents that alternative. And that's why everyone's so happy. And that's why after the announcement, we saw all these African leaders and foreign ministers and deputy presidents basically giving their pitch, saying what they can offer and why they want to be next in the next line of, you know, inductions to BRICS. All the African countries want to join. They don't want to be, you know, I live in Nairobi now. The Kenyan shilling's falling faster than, I don't want to use an analogy, but it's falling very fast because it's all dependent on the US dollar. All the currencies in Africa are falling because it's dependent on US dollar. And what BRICS represents is a real prospect of de-dollarization. And, you know, the dollar for the US has been a privilege, but it's abused that privilege consistently. And I think, you know, the only thing that can get us more excited about than African of African nations joining BRICS is this next step of a united BRICS currency.
So that really seems to be, to me, kind of the main appeal to BRICS, right? And from what you guys are describing, this kind of disunity in terms of what is this actually look like? How does this manifest? But just this fundamental motivation, right? We want to de-dollarize. We want to move away from having this one global reserve currency that's able to dictate the fortunes of entire countries. And on the sanctions question, right? Because you noted that Africa is the most heavily sanctioned continent on the planet. Obviously, Russia has been dealing with sanctions on a really stepped up level over the past year and a half, kind of an unprecedented level of sanctions being applied to them finally, right? And it seems to be having an impact now. We've seen the value of the ruble drop significantly in recent months, but there is this flip side to the overuse of sanctions, which kind of seems to be pushing more and more countries away from the dollar. So can you describe, Anya, the how the collective West essentially has accelerated this process of multipolarity through the use of sanctions?
I would say it's the sanctions are one thing. The question is, what do the sanctions do? And how does that actually reflect in the global economic exchange? And most journalists from the West, even if they're interested in these terms of multipolarity, I think don't really understand what currency, what questions of currency exchange, and especially the global commodities market, what that actually means in practice. And that's why this question of currency is so significant, because it's not as though BRICS, these powers, got together one day and said, we hate the United States because they are a colonial power. We hate the West because we were colonized. And we want to attack the dollar because it's an instrument of the West. What happened was the West made a succession of decisions because they're most focused on, this is a good way of putting it, people want to think of BRICS as an opponent of G7. When you look at the members of G7 and what G7 represents, they are the former colonial powers, the United States, the European colonial powers, and Japan. That means these are the powers that didn't have, well, the United States actually has wealth, but these other ones didn't have as much wealth. They don't have energy. They had to go throughout the rest of the world and extract it. And they thought for a long time, even after they relinquished their colonies, that they could build and establish this alternative neo-colonial form of development where they would give loans and try to help these former colonized countries after the Second World War, but still exercise authority over their sovereignty, still decide who owns the oil, we own the oil, still decide who you appoint to finance minister, still dictate the sovereign policy. That's the model of development that has existed since Bretton Woods and the establishment of the IMF and the World Bank. And what BRICS offers is an alternative form of development and exchange. That means they emphasize they're not against any individual country. They are against anything that usurps the charter of the United Nations. Again, there are people who think that BRICS is against the UN or going to replace the UN even. No, it's to say territorial sovereignty, political independence, and your own sovereign will as a country and national identity is what is there to, it exists to preserve that and allow for a forum where countries can exchange based on their own sovereign interests. Not that anyone is imposing an ideology or a currency. They want to work together and exchange in a way where the dollar can't be weaponized and instruments like SWIFT can't be weaponized in order to enforce sanctions. And so because the United States over the past 10 years, really, particularly targeted oil producers, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, major oil producers, the leading oil producers other than the United States, Canada, and a few others over the last decades, with sanctions that cut them off from the dollar, the U.S. thought that would lead to regime change. What it actually led to was that for years, all of these countries have been making exchanges and trading their oil and participating in the global market in a currency other than the dollar. There are different ways they do it. They do it with shared national currencies. They do it in gold swaps. there are ways for them, and it's never happened before in the history of the world, for them to exchange with each other and participate in the global economy without interference from the West. And so BRICS, a lot of people, I believe, in the West see now, because Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Egypt and Argentina, these countries that are very powerful economically, have joined, are blindsided. They think this is the launch of a multipolar world. It's really the consolidation of something that's been happening for years, as Wyatt, you said, as the direct result of Western policy. But it has to do with currency manipulation, and it has to do with targeting oil producers. Because at the end of the day, people want to buy oil. Russia and China, or India and China, are the largest oil consumers. They're going to be buying somebody's oil no matter what. And if you tell them they can't do it in the dollar, they're just going to go somewhere else. And that is what BRICS has demonstrated, that we went too far and it was inevitable.
Yeah. So it's not just, though, the United States, right? We've seen, we have obviously other sort of neo-colonial arrangements. I'm thinking specifically of ECOWAS, this kind of group of nations which, well, obviously... They have, there's been in the news recently, I'm thinking about Niger, right? The situation where there's a coup government, a junta that has seized power and appears to be appreciating quite a bit of popular support, I should note. But how, I want to get into kind of how these recent developments in West Africa have played out at the summit. We have seen quite a bit recently in terms of more threats from ECOWAS. We have seen just in the past couple hours, we got word from the foreign, that the foreign ministry in Niger has given the French ambassador 48 hours to leave the country because the French ambassador refused to meet with officials from the government there, from the new government. Can you kind of, Ahmed, describe the latest on the situation in Niger, the latest in terms of the possibility of this becoming an actual hot war and a regional war that takes over the region.
And if you're just joining now, you're watching or listening to The Gray Zone's Anya Parampil and Ahmed Caballo of African Stream live from Johannesburg, and it's pretty late there, so we're really grateful for them joining us. Like this stream, YouTube is suppressing it right now, and they demonetized our last stream, so like it. Ahmed, feel free to jump in.
Sure. So before I get to the latest of Niger, I think Niger can also act as an example of why BRICS is important. So if you look at Niger, you know, Niger, the reason why so many Pan-Africans and Africans in general got so excited about what's happening in Niger, it's not because we love military dictatorships. It's because Niger is the caricature, the example of neocolonialism. When you look at the statistics of companies like Areva and how much they were taking in royalties and how much the Nigerian government were making, you had to look at it twice to find out it was real. So from royalties paid, the Nigerian government, the previous Nigerian government, was getting around 6%, and the French-backed Areva was getting 94%. Now, that is the definition of neocolonialism. And the reason why they can do that is because the imperialist powers, they cordon off different parts of the planet as their sphere of influence. So France says Francophone is us. No one else is allowed to trade with Francophone countries, and have things that stipulate that whenever these countries try to trade with China, that France has first right of refusal. But within that first right of refusal, it's not that they have to match China's terms and conditions. They can just say you're not allowed to strike this trade deal. And what BRICS does, it really offers an alternative. And one thing that I found interesting when you looked at the different commodities that each BRICS nation offers, they've basically made sure that they're not relying on just Saudi Arabia for oil. They also have the UAE. They also have Russia. They're not just relying on Russia for gas. They also have Iran. They're not just relying on Argentina for soybeans or corn. They also have South Africa. So they've tried to create something that is kind of bulletproof for sabotage, So if there is a Nord Stream 2 pipeline, you know, accidentally blowing up again, then, you know, it's not going to devastate the German economy if Germany was part of BRICS, because they could just get their gas in theory from Iran, although it's more complicated than that. And that's what BRICS is. It's an attempt to break the monopoly of trade. So it's an attempt for these countries to be able to trade with each other. And if you're like Uganda, and I'm not saying that I support the draconian anti-gay law that comes out of Uganda, but I do think that if the law is going to be opposed, it's not going to be opposed by the State Department in the United States, but it should be opposed by the grassroots. If you impose a law that your parliament votes on and the parliament agrees, and it does seem to have, not saying I agree, I just have to keep saying that, it does seem to have some sort of support amongst the population. If you create a law, then if you're part of BRICS, you're not subject to the World Bank or the IMF saying, okay, well, we're going to stop this loan happening, or we're going to stop you from trading with this country, or we're going to cut you off from the financial market. You have more freedom. And with more freedom, what we're talking about is more sovereignty, because, you know, some of these states, they have flag independence, but they've never really gained economic independence. And what they think BRICS represents is an opportunity for some economic independence and able to trade with different countries on terms that are favorable. Now, in relation to Niger and whether it's going to turn into a hot war, it's a difficult one. If it was just up to, you know, the nations within ECOWAS pushing it, I'd say no, because there's demonstrations happening now in Cote d'Ivoire, in Nigeria, in Senegal, against their government and against their government's, you know, war rhetoric against Niger. However, the reason why it might still turn into a hot war is because Niger is just so important financially to France. And when the money is disturbed, I can't remember the French president. It was either Chirac or Sarkozy. I'm gonna guess it was Chirac. He said, "Without Africa, France would be relegated to a third world economy."
That was Chirac.
Chirac. And Niger is a big part of that contribution to French's economy. So if it thinks that it's going to lose Niger and it has no chance of getting Niger back, it will do everything in its power to stop that from happening. And unfortunately, you know, the chairman of ECOWAS at the moment, Grayzone did a fantastic expose on him, is Ahmed Bola Tinubu, who seems to have been placed there precisely for this reason, precisely for, you know, being the attack dog, the modern day Ascaris that were used by the French during colonial times against their fellow African brothers. And he really has nothing to lose. You know, he has serious allegations regarding electoral fraud. He has these court documents that you guys exposed in the Grey Zone article that show his dodgy heroin dealings in Chicago as a bagman. He has these WikiLeaks cables that show his strong connections to the US embassy. And if he moves away from the Western orbit, you can imagine them using all that against him and taking him out. So it's like I don't want to give him an excuse, because I still don't think he should be leading the charge. But you could see why, against the popular wishes of the people of, you know, ECOWAS and the populations, why they might go in that direction.
When you say that Niger and Africa in general, but especially Niger, was driving or sustaining the French economy, the colonial zombie, can you expand on that? Because I was, even as someone who I thought was well informed, surprised about what you told me about the level to which France was exploiting these former, ostensibly former territories still.
Yeah, it goes beyond usurping uranium reserves. It's
total
domination.
Total domination. So the 14 French-speaking African countries, they use the franc, and the franc's currency, 50% of it is held in Paris. And they get to dictate how that money is spent, what it's spent on. So, you know, this kind of pipeline that's going through Nigeria to Niger, the Nigerians benefit absolutely nothing from it because they don't have sovereignty over to decide whether, you know, the pipeline is going to go through in the first place. What is it going to benefit the people of Niger when most people don't have access to gas? 85% of people don't have access to electricity. I mentioned before about it has the first right of refusal. So we're always told that what underpins capitalism is competition, but they make sure there is no competition, that these former colonies that never really got their independence are not allowed to trade with who they want at favorable terms. When countries try to leave the CFA franc, like Guinea did in the 60s, the French destroyed all the infrastructure that they claim they built. When Togo tried to leave, the president was assassinated in front of the US embassy. Thomas Sankara spoke out against the CFA franc, spoke out against the cancellation of debt, was assassinated. So it's complete and total domination on the political sphere, on the economic sphere, on the trade sphere. And that's why, you know, so many people are coming out in Niger in support of the coup. Like I said, it's not that the people are obsessed with army officials. It's just that they know the definition of insanity, as Albert Einstein said, is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And if you continue with, you know, these kind of neocolonial puppets that serve the interest of a foreign country, while you remain the second poorest country in the world, with 85% of the country not connected to the electrical grid, then something needs to change. Something needs to change. And they think that the French domination is the reason why they're in a situation that they're in.
And just on that point, everything that Ahmed just described is precisely why the question of the BRICS currency or currency in general is so significant, because a lot of people, especially I think a lot of what I read in anticipation in Western media, but also international BRICS media or BRICS aspirant media, was concerned about whether or not BRICS was going to announce an actual currency. And Putin himself, as kind of the, I think people would say the most, he's in between the West and the East, and in some ways the most explicit in terms of the break that BRICS represents at this moment, at least with the West. He was very concerned about whether or not BRICS were going to determine how they're going to resolve their trade, whether it's going to be a joint currency basket exchange where every nation and every BRICS member can preserve some sort of currency sovereignty, or whether there's going to be a fixed exchange rate with one dominant currency based in a resource or something similar to what Bretton Woods originally was, based on the gold standard. And it didn't come out. It didn't happen because at least Lula and some of the other powers, this was something Lula from Brazil made off the bat, a point that he made explicitly in his original speech, was that in his first speech, because they gave multiple addresses throughout the whole negotiation process, was that the national sovereignty of every BRIC state, their currency has to be protected. So I think certain BRICS countries do not want to enter an agreement where they feel as though there's a dominant currency, a central currency that could in any way begin to undermine the sovereignty of BRIC states, especially because one of the main critiques you hear about BRICS from even current members, particularly India and South Africa and beyond that, aspiring African countries, is that they don't totally want to feel as though they are dependent on just the Chinese. And the Chinese, because they can offer the most investment, are the controversy. The Indians, especially because of their own relationship with China, don't want the Chinese to have... not that the Chinese are imperialist or are going to weaponize their currency in the same way, but there is a sense that preserving sovereignty of your currency is the best way to preserve your sovereignty, period. And the minute you start mixing it with something else, you walk down a slippery slope where you're already in a dynamic where you're not an equal partner. And so this question of the currency is very key. The franc, the French currency in the former French colonies Ahmed described how they can weaponize that even still to this day. Most people don't know that. And then the dollar also is a major weapon. And to say that they want to move away from that is not necessarily an attack. It's just an assertion of sovereignty. And so this is a big question going forward.
Well, so on that topic, I mean, it seems like the elephant in the room, right, was the death of Yevgeny Prigozhin, right, the head of the PMC Wagner group. In many ways, this kind of seemed to color a lot of the interactions that were happening at BRICS, from what I understand, at least, that this kind of hung over the summit in a way. Obviously, this downing of this plane occurring literally while Putin is giving this address. Can you kind of describe, did this, in your opinion, color what was happening in a significant way?
Ahmed, you first.
Of course, we thought it was going to. So I remember staying up all night, reading as much as I can in anticipation. But the next day, maybe that's why Anya actually sent me a message at 8 a.m. saying, because the plan was the speakers were meant to speak at 2 p.m. according to the email. And then all of a sudden, there was this announcement going to be made at 8 a.m. So maybe that was a way of not allowing, you know, the conversation to be distracted by, you know, the untimely death of the
You mean, wife. And you're specifying when Ramaphosa actually announced they were inviting it would happen.
Yes.
Way ahead of schedule. The people, honestly, I went there on accident. I went there accidentally because I just happened to be awake because of jet lag. And I said, I might as well set up and be ready. And then they said there's a press conference, but the only people there were really the state media because they were privy, and there were suddenly a bunch of other statements. I said, oh, the Iranians are here. I wonder what that means.
Yeah. So exactly. So it was day three. We were preparing ourselves to go to the conference hall around 2 p.m. And then all of a sudden there's this announcement at 8 a.m. And I think that was a way of, you know, taking the sting out of the big news that happened the night before. And then as soon as the announcement happened, that's what everyone was talking about. But of course, it is big news, and we could discuss it from an African perspective as well. Yeah, it's an interesting one because there's no doubt that Wagner's played a decisive role in the Sahel and Central African Republic against, you know, the Takfiri terrorist groups and the people of those regions, is particularly maybe not amongst Africa as a whole, but definitely those people whose lives have been turned upside down by the terrorist insurgency have appreciated Wagner's role. That being said, when this kind of mutiny happened, of course, the leaders of Burkina Faso, Mali, Central African Republic weren't saying anything against, you know, Wagner or Russia. But there must have been a feeling on the ground that if they can turn against their surrogates like this, then what does that mean for us on the ground? What does that mean for our military? So, you know, now that he's no longer in the situation, it kind of takes away that uncertainty that had kind of arisen because of, you know, do we call it a mutiny? What do we call it? I don't even know what. Some people call it a psyops. People call it a mutiny. Some people, well, how have you guys been describing it on the Gray Zone? What's the editorial line on what happened?
We call it.
I think we all have our own different theories. Why
we call it bigger than the Russian hacking that was bigger than Pearl Harbor and 9/11 combined, and January 6th. So whatever it is, in any case, as you said, Prigozhin is no longer in the situation. not in the situation room, definitely. I mean, I want to get back to the discussion of the global economy, but since we've gone down this road, you know, what was the reaction from the conference, and do people think, well, this was something that the Russian state had to do, or did they think, oh, it's impossible that Putin would have authorized such a thing in the middle of BRICS? I mean, what were people saying on the floor?
It depends on who you ask. And on a personal level, as anyone would be, there's just an intrigue. I mean, it's something out of a novel or a movie or a Netflix show. So people want to theorize. They just want to, what do you think? Oh, I don't know. But one thing that I can say is that regardless of how, whether or not someone would say that they support in theory Putin carrying out this act, or whether they don't, whether they think that it doesn't factor into the ultimate decision. And this is something that Westerners and people who are accustomed to G7 or NATO would can't really understand, which is it is an internal Russian issue. Technically, it is. And that is how I think Modi, Ramaphosa, Xi, Lula, and anyone else who came to the summit thought about it. It's interesting, but it doesn't change my interest in dealing with Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, the one other point that I'll make is not everybody takes it for granted that they know what's going on. And that's part of recognizing that it's an internal Russian issue. I'm not privy to, this was happening the moment that the main diplomats, well, the heads of state really, plus Lavrov, because Putin wasn't there, had broken away from the main conference and were having a cultural event and dinner. And that was when the news about the Prigozhin alleged death.
He's dead.
Well, that was news that it, that was when news broke. And so while everyone was interested, I don't think anyone immediately said, why would Putin do this? Or why is Putin doing this? They just,
right.
It's a Russian issue and we don't know what happened. It's an internal Russian issue. There's no assumption on who acted. So my point about the fact that I wasn't present at the dinner, I'm not sure what the official Russian state position was or what they had to say. Maybe they were as blindsided as anyone else. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, my personal opinion is.
But it doesn't matter. Do you have sources? What's your personal opinion on the assassination of something that someone in Russia?
Okay, well, moving along.
I want to hear your personal opinion.
Well, that's the way that people in it, that are dealing in this kind of world exchange think. They don't know.
But you made a good point that, you know, while it's an internal issue, it does have, you know, consequences, obviously, for the nations in Africa, you know, as Ahmed was kind of explaining, who have Wagner forces deployed there. Because the big question, what does this mean for our internal security situation if we're relying on this force to help stabilize the situation? But, I mean, it sounds like that perspective was kind of like, well, about time. I mean, am I wrong? I don't know.
Well, the U.S. had an interest in Prigozhin succeeding because they want Russia to be destabilized and balkanized, that they wanted to return to Russia in the 90s, and then Russia becomes a less reliable partner for other countries in BRICS. So I highly doubt this could be just perceived as an internal issue. But in any case, the threat has clearly been headed off. And
we don't know what happened. I mean, I'm saying that I'm not privy to the information, even as someone who was part of Ramaphosa's circle was. I'm sure the Russians had something to say that was based in the truth about what they know or what they think or what they did. But that's going to be how the Africans and everybody else are moving forward based on the information they actually get. We don't know. Yeah. We don't know. Who knows?
I think. I'm not going to say it's a good thing or a bad thing, but before this happened, myself, I just felt like it was the first time in international politics I didn't understand something. I was like, I don't understand how this guy's done an alleged mutiny, left to Belarus, comes back to St. Petersburg, is hanging around, goes to Mali, does a selfie video. It just didn't make sense at all. It just didn't make sense. And I think if you're going to deal with a nation and they're going to help you with your security, you have to understand how it operates. And I think this just provides just makes sense. Because, you know, maybe they, it just makes sense to everyone around. Like I said, I'm not saying it's a good thing. There was other people on board, probably had families, etc. I'm not trying to say it's a good thing. But it definitely, if it was the Russians, it definitely makes sense. And you want to be able to predict the actions of an ally who you're relying on for security. You don't want to think, I don't understand how they operate, you know, what they're going to do if this happens or that happens. You want to know, if someone threatens our security arrangement, that person will be dealt with.
Well, there's that Dave Chappelle sketch.
The act made sense if it had happened immediately. The timing did not. If you're ascribing
the timing logic, is bizarre.
I thought the timing could make sense in the sense that Prigozhin had been lured into a sense of false security and was on a plane with Utkin, who the Wagner group is named for. That's his call sign. He was their real military director. Prigozhin was just the money man. And it's like the vice president and the president of the U.S. rarely appear together for security reasons. Perfect target. And it seems to be fairly popular in Russia, and the Russian nationalist Telegram channels I follow seem pretty content with it.
All right,
with
as it. I
said. And the Nikki Haley seemed to be like portraying Prigozhin as kind of like a Russian dissident, like someone who is targeted because he wrote a satirical novel about Putin. I think the New York Post actually called him a dissident. So in any case, it is.
I think Putin was very heavily invested in the BRICS summit. I personally don't see how he would have gained from her. He could have done it after. He didn't benefit. He didn't lose because the BRICS decision was not going to be interfered with by something like Prigozhin's death. But Putin, I don't see where he gained. And judging from his own statements or his own acts, I don't know. Is he the kind of guy that would send a condolence to the family of someone that he just blew out of the sky?
Yes.
That's his only response. I think if Putin wanted him dead or wanted to do this, he could have done it at a different time and he would have explicitly said why. But
well,
that's just me.
My only conclusion is whoever was responsible, Prigozhin had a lot of enemies. The Russian state is stronger now.
I think the Russian defense forces that were actually the target of Prigozhin's mutiny and who may have been upset with Putin for not cracking down on Prigozhin would be my first suspect, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would say that's very plausible.
I would say that's impossible. Way more plausible than Putin himself having ordered the hit. Personally, that was
Putin in his computer cave. He's like, hack the election, then kill him. I mean, in any case,
Putin cares about what the world thinks. He cares about what India and Brazil and China and India and South Africa and everybody else who's coming to BRICS felt. Yeah, maybe he did this the night before they were going to announce the expansion just because Prigozhin is such a piece of crap. Maybe. Maybe he did.
Well,
and then said his only statement was, sorry, I'm sorry that this guy died, to his family.
Well, you're watching the Gray Zone Battle Royale live from Johannesburg. We have Gray Zone's Anya Parampil and Ahmed Caballo of African Stream joining us. And it's late there, so we're really grateful for their contributions. And I don't think we've talked enough about BRICS expansion as it relates to sanctions. I mean, Anya, can you just give us a brief primer on the petrodollar, how it's been used, and how the Western financial hegemony has been used to, or how the dollar-based international financial system has been used to enforce sanctions, and what membership of states like Iran, which have borne the brunt of US sanctions in BRICS, means for the future of this sanctions regime, which currently has been imposed on the lives of something like one third of the world's population?
It's a big question. I'll try to answer it in terms of a timeline that builds up to where we are now. And that's World War II drew the lines and ushered in, integrated the globalized economy. Whether or not it was the former colonized world or the colonizers after World War II, everything was linked. And certain colonizers claimed the spoils, and other colonized countries actually gained nominal independence. But, and it was ostensibly the end of European colonialism. But because of the establishment of the Bretton Woods system and the IMF, which linked the transatlantic powers in a way that was not, we weren't linked with Europe. We didn't view Europe necessarily as our historic allies, even though we were spawned by the colonial powers until the integration of the Second World War and the First World War that really, and so the IMF Bretton Woods system was supposed to be the rules of this newly integrated global economy. And they sold it through the IMF as a way to develop the newly independent, non-industrial, former colonial world by establishing a bank that was funded by the former colonial powers. So the G7, what is it? It's Germany, France, the United Kingdom, the United States, Japan, and South Korea. The seven there, they're the former colonial powers that came together that were extracting the wealth from the former colonized world. They established the World Bank, give their money as the baseline. But then if you're the developing world, sure, you want to come, you're newly independent, you want to get this money to develop your economy. It meant the IMF was actually going to, it was written into the terms. If you get an IMF loan, you have to liberalize your economy. Basically, your policies are subject to approval by the IMF, not your sovereign government. So you're not going to have a sovereign industrial base. You're not going to have a sovereign government. You're going to be constantly ferrying the questions about your economic policy over to the supranational transatlantic network. And so even though BRICS established that dynamic, it still did at least allow for competition of the national economies because it was based on the gold standard. The original Bretton Woods system was based on the gold standard of a fixed exchange rate. So they knew they needed one currency. If you have a newly integrated global economy, it's easier if everyone can trade in one currency. But if you have a national currency, you need a method for exchanging that back, if you're participating in the global market, back into a currency that is your national fuel for your economy. And so because of the fixed exchange rate, that meant anyone participating in Bretton Woods, if they had U.S. dollars and they were participating in this market, there was something called the U.S. Treasury gold window where they could come and they could exchange their dollars for gold, bring that to their central banks and convert it back into their national currency. But what happened was after World War II, after the Marshall Plan played out, the United States grew and exploited its victory in World War II to extract wealth out of Europe and Asia and subjugate Japan, Germany, these powerhouses of industry. Eventually, after a few decades, those countries started to recuperate their economy. And simultaneously, the United States government had lent out way more dollars than it actually maintained in gold in its Federal Reserve. So all these countries had billions and billions of dollars that meant nothing. If they came and they wanted to go to the treasury window and get their gold back, get their money back, it didn't exist. It was a fraction. Maybe there were like, I think, $3.2 billion that were available or worth of gold that was available for exchange when there were $13 billion circulating. And so unilaterally one night after France, Germany, and a collection of European states started calling back their dollars because they realized, wait, we got the short end of the stick. They've been financing the Vietnam War and the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, was all financed by this inflated dollar that didn't exist. That was how we built our U.S. empire. And so the European powers woke up and started calling their money back, and we didn't have the money to give. This is all written about by mainstream American, even David Frum writes about this in his book. When the Europeans began calling back their gold, we had none. The U.S. gold reserves dropped. to the lowest in the history of the United States. And so unilaterally one day, Nixon closed the gold window at the U.S. Treasury Department, said it is no longer can any country that has dollars exchange for gold. They even went to a meeting of the G7 in Rome that year and said, the dollar is our currency, but it's your problem. Sorry. And so no one wanted dollars anymore. And Nixon fixed that by establishing the petrodollar agreement with Saudi Arabia just 2 years later, in the midst of the international oil crash, when Saudi Arabia actually stopped selling its oil to the West. There were these huge gas lines, huge gas prices, a crisis. Nixon sent the Treasury Secretary and Secretary of State, including Kissinger at the time, to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, which was the largest exporter of oil, as a result of that meeting, decided to only accept U.S. dollars in exchange for its oil as long as the U.S. gave them weapons. And so that's the basis of the petrodollar, the special relationship with Saudi Arabia. It meant that any country that wanted to buy oil in the world, even if they were trying to buck the dollar, had to have dollars if they wanted to buy oil. And that's lasted up until this point. And U.S. sanctions in recent years have cut off Iran. They've cut off Venezuela, Russia, major oil producers from accessing dollars. And so by their own actions now, the whole oil, big players in the oil market aren't trading in dollars. And why would they? Now even Saudi Arabia knows eventually the dollar is going to be weaponized against them. So now they're turning to the rest of the world and saying, let's start exchanging between ourselves. Forget about this special arrangement with the United States. They have to come to terms with the only value that they have in their money is their military. And everybody knows that. That's the only reason now the dollar is the world's reserve currency. There's no other value, tangible value to the U.S. dollar. No oil, no gold.
Yeah, it seems clear that the petrodollar has never been more vulnerable. What's called the exorbitant privilege of the United States dollar in terms of dominating global financial markets has never been quite so on the ropes. And obviously, we see this manifested in the addition of these six new countries into BRICS: Egypt, Ethiopia, Argentina, the UAE, and then Iran and Saudi Arabia, right, which have been rivals for decades, which had this really dramatic rapprochement over the past year. But we still, even now, see attempts, obviously, by the United States as part of kind of these ongoing efforts at prompting some kind of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. We've seen reports that a key demand from the United States would be that Saudi Arabia continue selling oil in dollars, right? So we're at this kind of inflection point, I think, where much of the rest of the world kind of gets to decide which direction they want to go. So Ahmed, could you describe, you know, we saw the introduction of these six countries, but we've heard interest from at least 40 other countries, according to South African President Ramaphosa. So what is next for BRICS and what is next for multipolarity?
Yeah. Firstly, I just want to say to Anya, that was a brilliant breakdown. I've never heard someone break it down in such a simple but digestible way. So, you know, thank you for that. Kudos. Now, before I talk about the other additions, I think there's an important point to talk about that we haven't discussed so far regarding these six. Now, the two African countries are not just two random African countries. They're two countries that have been at loggerheads for some time now, which is Ethiopia and Egypt. And it actually suggests BRICS as a vehicle for peace. So we saw Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we, you know, at the time, again, it was one of those scratch your head moments. Do I understand geopolitics? I didn't quite understand how China was the one to mediate peace between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But now we've seen that Iran has been admitted into BRICS and Saudi Arabia has been admitted into BRICS. You do start to wonder if that was a precondition that, listen, if you make peace, it could benefit you economically. We're thinking about letting you guys join BRICS, but we can't have two member states at BRICS that, you know, are fighting proxy wars in Yemen against each other. Who knows? And I'm hoping that I'll have the same ramifications for Ethiopia and Egypt.
So just for context, we had obviously this, the point of contention here is the Grand Resistance Dam, right? Yeah. We've seen more or less open threats from Egypt
to
essentially bomb this dam because of the water situation, how it affects the Nile. So sorry, just to give a little bit of context.
A little bit of context. And to add to it, you know, there's several rumors about what's behind the Sudan conflict.
You've been listening to the first half of the Gray Zone's live stream from the BRICS Summit in South Africa with Max Blumenthal, Wyatt Reed, Anya Parampel, and Ahmed Caballo. To hear the full live stream, visit the Gray Zone's YouTube channel, which you can find linked at our website, thegrayzone.com. That's the GRAYzone.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Telegram, and Instagram. Thanks for listening. I've been your co-host, Christopher Weaver.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for your donations and overwhelming support of this listener-sponsored community radio, KPFK. It is the support of listeners like you that keeps this station strong, fiercely independent, and powered by the people. Thank you from all of us at Pacifica Radio's KPFK 90.7 FM.
KPFK presents a special benefit screening of When Houston Had the Blues, Sunday, September 10th at the Lemley Royal Theater located at 11523 Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles. When Houston Had the Blues is a celebration of the city that gave us giants like Lightnin' Hopkins, Big Mama Thornton, Clifton Chenier, and Bobby Blue Bland. You're invited to join us on September 10th at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. for the VIP reception, including a meet and greet with the director of the film, Alan Swire, plus Rhapsody in Black host Bill Gardner and a cavalcade of music stars from the film, including Billy Vera, Carla Olson of the Textones, Tony Bronigal, drummer for both Taj Mahal and Bonnie Raitt, and more. More information and tickets available at kpfk.org.
Now, baby, please don't go. Now, baby, please don't go.
Hey, wanna brush up on your Spanish and discover a world of news, public affairs, arts and culture? Tune in Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight for KPFK en Español. This Tuesday night, starting at 8 p.m., get your daily dose of Español with Informativo Pacifica. At 8:30, Voces de Libertad. 9:30, Insurgencia Femenina or Arrabaleros de Magón. 10:30 p.m., Suplemento Comunitario. And at 11:30, Centroamérica sin Censuras. Remember, KPFK habla Español. Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight. Tune in and tell a friend.
This is Dan Navarro, host of Strike Line here on KPFK 90.7 FM. Join me this Wednesday, September 6th at 5 p.m. Pacific, when my guest will be actor Jason George, hit TV series regular, member of the SAG-AFTRA National Board, and the TV Theatrical Streaming Negotiating Committee. We'll spend the better part of an hour looking at the realities of acting careers in television past, present, and future, and what's at stake in the 50-plus day SAG-AFTRA strike. This Wednesday at 5 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
On the next alternative radio, hear Nader Hashmi, Iran, the struggle for democracy. That's alternative radio, Friday mornings at 7, right here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.